Today we had guest Justin Marriott on our program. Justin is an investment banker, business broker. And David and I were both interested in talking to him just because, you know, we're small business guys and curious how these transitions happen, how the successions happen, and just the whole transaction process. So I thought Justin did a great job talking us through that process and kind of how he puts things together, how he puts deals together and then takes things to market, you know, for the owners of the company, whether they be really small or a little bit larger company. So all in all, it's a great topic. Justin's got a couple decades of experience in the industry, and he was very forthcoming, I thought, and very clear with his explanations of how things operate.
Yeah, I agree. That's one of the things I enjoyed kind of the most, is getting some of the actual kind of hardcore facts, if you will, and kind of if you're looking at buying a businesses, what are some of the percentages or the indicators that you're looking at, maybe just the certain size of their customer base, and just the different details that go into it. So I liked all the facts that Justin shared with us today and the wealth of knowledge he was. So hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome to another episode of the Healthy Team, Healthy Business podcast. We're very excited today to have Justin Marriott of Marriott & Company. They're a kind of a boutique investment banking firm, and he joins us today from his office in Richmond, Virginia. Justin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, so we met a couple of weeks ago. We got to learn a bit about your business. You got to learn a bit about my business. And we had, I thought, a great conversation and kind of said, hey, we have a podcast about business. Maybe you'd be willing to come talk to us, because this is not a topic we've covered. Succession planning, we talked a little bit with an attorney, but only briefly. So we can talk about some of those kind of topics today. But could you just, for our listeners, maybe just kind of talk about your background and your business a little bit, and so we kind of set up where we're headed?
Sure. So I've essentially spent my entire career in mergers and acquisitions. So I started my career, got out of graduate school, and went to Charlotte and joined a really large investment banking firm that is now Wells Fargo Securities. And we worked on pretty larger transactions and a lot of public company stuff, and worked for a lot of private equity, mostly working for private equity, selling portfolio companies for those guys. That was a two-year position. It was an analyst position where I kind of learned the analytics, how to value businesses, how to write basically offering memorandums or confidential information memorandums, how to market a company. And it was a you know, kind of a whirlwind 2 year experience working about 80 hours a week, kind of crazy. So you do that for 2 years. And then typically what happens to the guys in that profession is a lot of times they'll go back to business school, or they'll go join private equity groups, or sometimes occasionally they'll promote you from within and you could go straight to become an associate. I had actually gotten my master's in economics before I had graduated college early and rolled right into that program. And so I didn't really want to go back to business school. And so I thought private equity looked interesting. So I got a job up here in Richmond at a small PE firm. We were doing buyouts of companies kind of throughout the Mid-Atlantic. It's pretty interesting. I started as an associate there and eventually grew into that position, became kind of the marketing partner that was going out and getting new assignments, you know, getting new transactions for us to work on. So I did that about 9 years. And we were working on smaller transactions. We were working with companies, probably $1 to $5 million of EBITDA, kind of what they look like. So a little bit smaller deals. And what happened to me in professional was I kind of started identifying more with the entrepreneurs. I really kind of, all these guys I was helping to, you know, buy parts of their companies or help them go and do other acquisitions and participate in that with those guys. I kind of just kind of get bit by the bug myself. And I said, I just want to kind of do something for myself here. And I think it would have been challenging to raise a brand new private equity firm, to go out and raise a lot of capital, you know, because again, I was a pretty young guy at that time. And all I've been doing is buying companies or selling companies at that point in my career. So I decided to go back to the investment banking side, get back into selling companies or raising money for companies. So I was about the age of 35, literally announced I was selling my partnership interest back to these guys and went out on my own and hung a shingle back in 2007 and got an office right here in the James Center. And just kind of went off to the races there. We ended up getting a pretty large energy company right out of the gates, kind of spin out from Dominion Energy, that we ended up selling to a private equity group down in Florida. And, you know, 15, 16 years later, I guess we closed, you know, close to 60 transactions, kind of all over the United States, primarily working with companies, you know, as small as a couple million dollars EBITDA, up to almost $20 million EBITDA on the larger side. And I don't know if your listeners, when I say EBITDA, that's essentially it's really the cash flow of a business, the earnings of the company prior to making interest payments, tax payments, or depreciation or amortization charges. So what you're trying to essentially do by looking at EBITDA is look at what the company, it's so you can get an apples to apples comparison to other companies, because it ignores how a company's capitalized, or, you know, it's structured as a pass-through entity, or if it's a C corporation, so it takes taxes off the equation. So it's really giving you the ability to look at different companies, ignoring how they're capitalized or ignoring the structure of the company. And that's really the metric we all use in our industry to value businesses, typically a multiple of that EBITDA, a different industry trade for different valuations. So anyways, long story short, so we've been doing this about 15 years. We've got a 6-person team here, primarily selling businesses to strategic buyers, both public and private companies, private equity firms, and family offices. And family offices act a lot like private equity. They're usually super wealthy families that maybe sold a business for themselves out acquiring other businesses in that particular industry. And sometimes they get to the point where they're diversified and own multiple companies in those families. But they kind of act like as financial buyers too. So that's essentially what we've been doing the last 16 years. So it's interesting. We're a generalist firm, so we work on a variety of different industries, a lot of heavy industrials, manufacturing, consumer products companies, healthcare businesses, telecom businesses, logistics, transportation, you name it. So it's a pretty broad, you know, swath of industries that work on stuff kind of all over the United States, heavy concentration in the Southeast and Midwest, and then done stuff as far as Connecticut and as far west as California. Because we represent it. Primarily entrepreneur family-owned businesses.
When you're selling or helping to sell these different businesses, how do you handle the aspect of the wide variety of businesses? If one day you're trying to sell a tech company and the next it might be manufacturing, how are you able to intelligently kind of help to sell that to a potential buyer?
Yeah. So, you know, over the years, you've had a lot of experience in a lot of these different industries. And we've gotten pretty smart in some of these industries where like healthcare, for example. I can look at these are usually multi-site, either medical practices or dental practices. I've done a lot of deals in that space. The first time I got into it, I had to kind of do my own research a little bit. And the way you value a business, there's typically four kind of methodologies. One being just kind of a look at what public companies will trade for in the industry, and taking a discount for size and liquidity. That's called a comparison to public companies. And that'll give you a kind of a multiple that they would trade for. Another one is looking at deals in that particular industry, what they're trading for. We have a bunch of different databases, and a lot of them have some of those private deal transactions. A third methodology is it's called a leveraged buyout analysis. It's looking like back when I was in PE and private equity, we would run these LBO models where we could see what we could afford to pay for a company based on the amount of senior debt available, mezzanine debt available, what kind of equity we could put in the transaction and achieve the returns we want to achieve. So that was kind of a third methodology we always use. And a fourth is kind of, it's the most theoretical. It's called a discounted cash flow. It always results in sort of the highest valuation. So that's when you look at a company kind of cold like that, those are the sort of four methodologies we'll use to kind of, you know, see what the company should trade for. And then a lot of it's just rule of thumb based on the size of the company. Certain industries are hotter than other industries and stuff like that. And so some of it's a little bit gut feel, qualitative, what we think the company will trade for. So that if I was going into a new industry, we'd probably do a valuation and some of it would just be gut feel from knowing what's kind of out in the industry. And I would get a pretty good range where I think companies will trade for. But I'll tell you the truth, I've been surprised sometimes to the good, surprised sometimes to the bad, what a company will trade for in a marketing process. And, you know, we're running basically an auction process for these companies. So it's a lot of price discovery. And, you know, I'm always confident whatever we've gotten by the end of that is where the company should trade. It's a real market value at that point. But everything else I've done at that point is kind of more theoretical, I guess you could say at that point, prior to running a marketing process.
Beyond the numbers, do you get into the nuts and bolts of the business? I mean, if it's a, you know, one of your smaller companies, I mean, maybe they only have got 50, 60 employees or something, and you know, small, close knit management team, that kind of stuff. I mean, do you get that granular, or do you try to just learn enough, know the numbers, and then take it to market?
Yeah, we've typically we write this offer memorandum. These documents are anywhere from it's gotten a little simpler. We used to write in more of a book form, but our industry's moved to kind of more of a PowerPoint type of a presentation. But there's still a 30 to 40 page deck, and it takes us anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks to write one of these. And you know, there's some diligence sessions up front with a client, and then we kind of go off and do our own research. And, you know, we're building a buyer's list, we're writing this book, but it kind of covers the operations of the company, the history of the company, the competitors of the company, industry trends, macro trends. We pull down a lot of research talking about just general growth in industry. We spend a lot of time almost kind of going in there on the historical financials and really digging pretty deep, looking to really make sure we understand how the company's behaved over the last, 3 to 5 years is what we're really focused on, primarily the last 3 years. We help them build a financial model. So we got to get in there well enough and understand it well enough to help them do projections for a company. Most companies we work for, if they do any kind of budget, any kind of projections, it's 12 months max. When you run these types of processes, you have to build like a five-year budget. All these groups, primarily private equity groups and family offices, they're looking to hold these investments for 5 years, and they're running this LBO model themselves, seeing what they can afford to pay for a company and making certain value judgments of sell about how fast or how quickly these companies can grow and service the debt and what the opportunities are. So we have to know it well enough to be able to kind of help them with their projections and understand the buyer universe and understand who's kind of out there. So it's a deep dive on a new industry. So every time I do a new industry, it's better if I can do multiple deals in the industry, because it takes us a lot to get up to speed. And I've always tried to, it's worked out in some industries where I've done multiple deals in the industry, and I like that, because it's like, it's easier for every time I have to write a book the next time. But when we take a new industry on, and it's the first time I write that book, that it is a challenge. Just make sure you're up to speed on everything going on in the industry and what you trade for and who's out there and who the competitors.
Curious, this is kind of a side tangent, but when you mentioned the historical financials, I mean, it's 2023 now. We're just coming out of a series of years that nobody in our lifetime has ever seen, as far as what happened with the pandemic and stuff getting turned upside down. I'm just curious, are the numbers different these last couple of years, or do you now have to look at things differently or try to take a bigger window?
Yeah, you do. And I sold some businesses in 2020 and 2021. I actually sold a lot in 2021. And we were having to really go back and almost ignore certain, periods of time. Like, and it's almost healthcare transactions. There were, several months where the state mandated these guys shut down, and we just had to literally pull those out of the financials and build around that. But even businesses that didn't shut down were impacted, in some cases way to the good, in some cases way to the bad, and trying to normalize and kind of get through some of that noise. And even some of the businesses that were impacted way to the good, we had to almost tamper expectations down some with those clients that you weren't going to be able to get full credit for some of that stuff that was going on in 21 or 22 in particular. And they would look at longer averages. So that was happening on some of those deals. They were looking further out and doing sort of averages, where historically you're looking at a trailing 12 months number and a forward number would be the two that were most commonly valued off of. And in some of these cases, they were going back and almost doing averages and kind of doing it that way. So a little bit of art, how we kind of we're taking those companies out, especially, the height of COVID and then a year or two after. I feel like a lot of the companies now, there's still some, lingering effects of all that, but a lot of stuff's been a lot more normalized than it was, 36 months ago or 20. Okay.
If someone was going to prepare to sell their business and reached out to you, what would some steps be recommended to prepare them to sell their business, get you the financials so you could start to review it? And then what could they maybe continue to do on their end while you're doing that? What are some things to focus on?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, and again, getting ready to go to market. But prior to that, I mean, if you're looking a couple years out for a sale, depending on where you are, with the company, getting your financial house in order, making sure that you have depth in management team. One of the things, especially on some of the companies we represent sometimes, sometimes the entrepreneur does so much, that's almost a detriment. These guys kind of, they can't ever get out. They the more you build up that management team below you, usually the better off you're going to be in a potential sale, because that's what all these guys want, sort of depth of management. They don't want totally depend on that one person. And getting your financial house in order, that's, you know, just, you know, reviewed financials, audited financials, whatever you're comfortable doing it in an audit, it'd be really good. Most of my clients don't have that. Most of them have either typically reviewed financials, but running everything through the business, running it like, you know, running it like it's a public company. That's one way. If you have enough time to do it that way. A lot of times I don't have that luxury and I'm getting into it and they haven't done that type of prep work. So we have to kind of go in and really normalize the earnings and spend a lot of time doing that. And, you know, trying to make sure we can get absolute credit for all that. But people have spent more time getting ready to go to market. That's definitely easier, putting the financials together. Once we get an assignment and, you know, start doing our work to get the materials ready to go to market, the one thing I would always tell a client is, this is a, you know, it's a 6, 8, 9 month process a lot of times to sell a company. And it's a lot of, you know, there's going to be a lot of highs and lows in this process, and there's going to be some periods of time where the entrepreneur is going to have to, you know, do a lot of stuff outside the normal course of their running their business day to day. And it's tricky because, you know, you're going through these, you know, manager presentations and meeting all these different groups and trying to figure out who you want to partner with. And you don't ever want to lose sight of, number one, no matter what, as long as the business performs, you know, you're going to be in good shape. And sometimes, you know, it's happened before, somebody will take their eye off the ball and get so embedded in this process and so, you know, into it that, you know, they could let the numbers slip a little bit. And that's not good for anybody in a sales process. So I would always tell guys, no matter what, you know, the business comes first and operate in a normal course and continue doing your best. And don't take your eye off the ball in one of these processes, because it's, you know, it's easier said than done sometimes, because they do get pretty involved, especially when you get under letter of intent and you get this 60-90 day window where you're doing an operational, financial, legal due diligence. It can be pretty time consuming outside the normal course of business.
So kind of piggybacking on that, how involved do you try to get the current ownership in the selling process? You take them out to do presentations to answer questions, or they need to be available if needed. I guess it could, maybe each deal is different.
Each deal is a little different, but I'd say historically what we've done is the upfront commitment. Usually there's a day where we want to sit down with whoever's involved, going to be involved in the transaction. Sometimes it's just the CEO, sometimes it's the CEO and CFO of the company. And sometimes even a little bit further down the management team. We'd want to spend a day kind of, we have a, you know, due diligence session where it's a kind of a Q&A, you know, 4 to 5 hour meeting where we're trying to understand everything we can about the business. We also have, you know, we'll try to get some materials ahead of time requests. We have a request list and we'll have some follow-up requests from that meeting. After that, we kind of go away for about that 4 to 6 week time period where we're building the book and building the buyer's list. When we go to market, really try to stay out of the hair, out of the entrepreneur, and just kind of like, let us go work on, you know, getting NDAs out, getting books out. It's a two-bid process trying to drive these guys to an indication of interest and eventually to a letter of intent. We don't really try to make them available to anybody during this process. It's not until we get those initial indications of interest that we sit down with our client and say, okay, here are these 10 different groups. I think we should invite 5 or 6 of these groups through to meet with you all and do some management presentations. It'll be a chance for them to interview you and you to interview them. That's typically the first time that our clients have interaction with these potential buyers. And it's kind of on purpose because we really want to get through this whole marketing process, see who's really going to be a potential player for us, and not really try to burn out the management team or burn out our client at that point. It's just like, let us go to work. Let us get the offers for you. Let us sit down with you and let's think about who we want to try to bring into these meetings. At that point, that is intensive period of time for the management team, or, you know, whoever's going to be involved in these presentations. That's typically a 1 to 2 week time frame where we're trying to do maybe back-to-back meetings. There's usually dinners or lunches involved in a lot of these meetings. It's a pretty intense time frame, but it's pretty important because that's where, you know, you've seen these offers on paper, but you haven't met these people, you haven't talked to these people. That's the first chance you're really going to get to kind of interview. And if it's a private equity or a family office deal, you're going to be involved going forward, typically in a, usually a 5-year time frame with those guys. If it's a strategic sale, you're just looking to exit. That's a little different. But if it's a private equity or a family office sale, that's important. I mean, it's like you're entering into a partnership with that group for the next, potentially 5 years or so. So that's an intensive time on the manager team, but a good time to really, really get involved. Once you kind of get through that process and you kind of pick a, select a winner and get under letter of intent, you go exclusive with one party. There's different work streams there. There's the financial work stream that usually falls under the controller, CFO of the company. Operational diligence stream, there will be a commitment there from the owner, typically, doing some follow-up diligence type requests. Legal, you're going to be reviewing all the legal documents with the bankers and the attorneys and stuff. There'll be some commitment there. But again, it's different spurts of the transaction kind of coming there. A lot of times the lawyers are doing their thing, we're doing our thing, the accountants are doing their thing. But there are different times when there needs to be a lot of involvement from the seller throughout the transaction. But it just kind of comes in little waves. It's not the whole time. That's the benefit of using an outside investment bank to run this process for you. It's a full-time job for us to run these processes. And I've seen some guys try to do this themselves, and it never really works because typically they take one of the first offers they get. And it's usually, somebody's putting a preemptive bid on your company. It's usually not a very high bid. You really need to go through an auction and kind of ring out, that incremental marginal buyer that's going to be your spike bidder. And you're only going to be able to uncover that if you really run a pretty thorough process. I mean, it's not uncommon for us to go out to, a couple hundred groups on those assignments and give, 10, 20 offers and get some of these deals. And, you invite 5 or 10 of those groups through, and, it's a process. It's not like, not quite like a public offering, but it's what it is. It's basically a private offering.
So with it being such a kind of a long, arduous process, do you have a time in which you recommend a business create that exit strategy? I mean, best is to do it right before you even start that business, or if you have one up and running, start it now, even if you don't think you're going to sell, or?
I think you should. I think you should have a goal in your mind of wanting to eventually sell the business and run it. Some people maybe they just have like a lifestyle business or something, and maybe there really isn't a market for a particular company like that. But most people, they get into business to grow it and have an eventual liquidity event. That'll be most of the entrepreneurs I work for. Most of their net worth is tied up in these businesses, so they really need to get to that liquidity event so they'll be able to retire someday. So setting a goal 5-10 years out. I mean, I've had guys that, they've told me kind of each year what their plans are to get to a certain level they need. They've talked to me and said, hey, if I had this kind of EBITDA, where do you think I would trade? And give them back the envelope number. And they start working towards a goal like that. We've had clients we picked up that, we've been talking to for 4 or 5 years. And just time was just right. And then, even when your business timing is right, that might not mean it's right to go to market, because you've also got macro factors out there in the general economy that can, cause you not to want to take a company to market. There's better times than not to go to market with these companies. So it's good to have sort of at the micro level, your plans, your goals for eventual exit, but then you have to be somewhat cognizant of what's going on in the macro markets too.
What I'm trying to just kind of picture both sides of this equation. So maybe you could just play a little bit of both sides. So if you were to give advice to an investor who is interested in starting to maybe expand their portfolio and buy some, small to mid-sized businesses, kind of what would you say to them? How would you get them prepared? What should they be looking for? And then the same thing, you kind of already done it on the buyer side or on the seller side. But again, how much of the stuff that needs to be, that's not financial, that you need to be talking to these people about too on the selling side?
Yeah.
That they need to be aware of, and then things you've seen, pitfalls, et cetera.
Yeah. Besides the biggest pitfall I've seen is just over reliance on that single entrepreneur. The other thing, and it's interesting too, growth is good, but then I've seen some companies over the years that get too dependent on one or two customers or, three customers, mm-hmm. to the point where they get such a concentration, you know, sometimes it might be 50% of the revenues might be tied up with one client and one customer. And that just makes a sale really hard. I mean, because what's going to happen in that instance is, you know, this could be a customer you could have for 20 years and they've been such a great customer and they're 50, 60% of your business, but an outside buyer is not going to value them like you value them. And they could be fearful that client goes away and then, you know, what's going to happen to your business. And so whenever we get something with a heavy customer concentration, it's, you know, it will tend to lead to a lower multiple for the business, or it might even involve some holdback in the, you know, a guarantee that client's going to be there, that customer's going to be there for a period of time, a year, 2 years, 3 years. And we might be holdbacks in the purchase price associated with that customer. So I always tell people in a, you know, perfect world, if you can grow your business and grow it every year at a good clip, but don't get too dependent on any one customer. It's easier said than done, because obviously I know how life is, and sometimes you have some great relationship with somebody and they sometimes will take over the business a lot. But I have seen that, and that seems to be a pitfall of a lot of companies have that pitfall, just an over-reliance on one or two key customers, and keeping a diversified customer base is pretty important. I would say that's one of the bigger things I've seen a lot of that makes it challenging sometimes to market a company.
What would that percentage be? I mean, you said 50, but when does it start to become, you know, something that investors are going to get worried? 30, 40? What's the...
Yeah. I'd say 30. I'd say as long as you're 20% below, no problem at all. 25%, you're probably still good. We start getting up to about a third of the revenues, then it starts getting a little dicey. Maybe they would start looking at, you know, discount that a little bit. And we get about 50%, then it gets really, I mean,
yeah.
I have sold businesses do have over 50% concentration, but it was, you know, there was some structure around those transactions, so we had to do those.
Yeah, what the business that we purchased and my father did, what a year after taking over, they had a customer that was about 20 to 25% and they left within a year and they switched to a different method of embellishing. So I've lived through that thing firsthand and can feel the pain. Yeah. And that's always one of the top questions I ever want to know with somebody, just because I can feel the pain of that firsthand.
It's tough. And even in especially the case, like a lot of times these financial buyers, they're using leverage in these transactions too. So it's not, you know, they're having an outside bank in there, maybe an outside mezzanine or subordinate debt fund in there. And you lose a customer 20-25%. That gets you start blowing some covenants. Next thing you know, you're having to deal with the guys in that workout group or something. They haven't worked through that process, and that's not fun. That's a distraction of the business for sure. So again, when you're using leverage and, you know, third party debt on these transactions, that becomes really it's part two for a strategic buyer might be using this leverage too, but especially in these financial transactions, that's. That's kind of a key thing to really understand with customers.
From the buyer standpoint, kind of that original part of that question, what do you think a buyer needs to be thinking about when they're thinking about expanding a portfolio or investing in a business? I know some of the ones you're dealing with are probably professionals at this, but
yeah,
trying to think of the less institutional people. Maybe you got an entrepreneur that grew his business and they would like to find another one in another state or something to work out or something like that. And you know, what do those guys need to be paying attention to and thinking about?
Things I would look for just be like, you know, how recurring are the revenues, right? A recurring revenue business, you know, barriers to entry. What is it, how defensible is it? What kind of moat is around that business? You know, those types of issues. Like we've had businesses that we've worked for that had a lot of patents that kind of really give some protection. One time I worked for a great company out in California that was in the security alarm business, and, you know, going out and acquiring customers, these were residential alarm monitoring accounts. And this is it was one of the top, 30 alarm companies in the United States. They had accounts like 35 different states. And once somebody has an alarm account, that's typically a contractual, I think it's usually a 5-year deal, and they just kind of auto renew. That business gets pretty easy. Once you get a pretty good base in there, it gets to be, you get some real, just steady recurring revenue, and it's pretty easy to manage that business. And, you're kind of throwing all those to a call center, and monitoring that account and stuff. And in that particular company was, they were a large company in terms of the industry, but relatively small in terms of number of actual employees that were needed for that, particular business, manage in all these accounts in 35 different states. That was a really nice business, but it had real high barriers to entry going out and, getting those initial accounts and growing that business and putting alarms in people's homes and getting people signed 5-year contracts. So the guy had a lot of value. I traded for a really, really high multiple with that particular business. So that was a really, really nice one in terms of having what you would want as an investor, with the recurring revenue, high cash flow. I mean, it was like a 50% kind of EBITDA type of margin type of business.
Right.
Yeah, gross margins of like a software company, essentially. So it's a really, really sweet business.
If you were that potential investor looking at, to try to find a deal like the one you just mentioned, that alarm company, there's brokers all over the place. How do you start to maybe find those deals and maybe find kind of the brokers that are worth talking to?
Yeah. If I was an individual, there are certain, I'm not like this, but there are certain groups that'll specialize in an industry. There were guys who all they did was work in the security alarm space, selling alarm companies, contacting those guys, word of mouth, some of this might be attorneys or accountants in your area, kind of your circle of influence, reaching out to those type of people, letting them know you're out there and you're looking for stuff in the marketplace. If I were looking to buy something myself, I'd be looking for something, within a, either in my town or within a couple of hours driving time, so I could get to relatively quickly. So I would probably try to work that market, people who are selling companies in those particular markets, maybe some of the service professionals that were doing M&A in those markets, just kind of let them know I'm out there and aware. And then, I might even research some companies myself that look interesting to me and just, reach out myself and just say, hey, I've got some capital. I'm looking to buy something in your particular industry and just try to, network. There was actually a company like that. I think it kind of, there was actually an alarm company here in town. I think that was kind of how the transaction happened. It was a buyout group out of Chicago, a small family office. And I think he was just doing sort of outreach like that and was able to get that particular company down in Chesterfield through outreach like that. That's how I understand the transaction came about.
Is that kind of, you're seeing a lot of that now with the generational shift that's happening? I mean, we know that, our population is getting older. There's probably a lot of baby boomers that are ready to exit the workplace or exit the business they started. And perhaps their next generation is not interested. I'm curious if you're seeing that particular sort of that looking client popping up more.
Yeah, I was going to say, I do. Basically, if you boil it on my clients, I think there's really two types. There's a lot of times the emerging first generation entrepreneur. This is going to be his first liquidity event. That's one type of client I have. And then the other one, it's that second, sometimes even third generation, grandson of the founder type of company, where they're just looking to exit that particular business and maybe they're not interested or maybe their kids aren't interested in taking it over. I've got a couple of situations like that where it's literally that third generation and their kids aren't interested in taking over the business. So I do see a lot of those. So yeah, it really is kind of that first generation really won't have their first liquidity event. Or it's a closely held business that's been in the family for a long time, and that third or fourth generation maybe doesn't want to be in that business or doesn't have a desire to be in that business. So that drives a lot of these sales.
Are you seeing now with money being a little bit more expensive, more owner financing? Is that increased a percentage wise, or is that just still kind of dependent?
I've seen some seller notes or seller participation like that. It's interesting. There are a lot of these, I call them, they're like alternative lenders, non-bank lenders. They're almost like private equity groups that do debt or credit. Most of the deals I've been seeing recently have involved those types of parties, not really traditional banks. They've been more specialty, sometimes called unitranche lenders. They do senior debt and mezzanine debt or subordinated debt funds. But a lot of these alternative capital sources that are kind of coming in to kind of facilitate buyouts. I've seen a lot more of that. There are still traditional banks out there doing deals, but I've seen more of these alternative lenders stepping in and filling some of that void. That's more so than seller. I mean, we've done some deals that might have a note in there, but not that many. I mean, maybe more than historically we've ever done, but not that many really. It's been these other groups kind of filling those gaps.
Haven't sold any in Bitcoin yet, have you?
I don't touch that stuff. I don't know, easier business to understand.
Yeah, I just wondered. Yeah, I'll give you 8 Bitcoin for that company. Oh, that's crazy. Wondering what the what do you think the next trends are in business transition, business brokerage, maybe that we haven't touched on yet or that you're seeing? Is this still the way it was when you started, 25 years ago, or is it?
Some parts are the basic. Yeah, I say the basic way we do it is very similar. I think the technology's gotten better in terms of being able to identify groups, potential buyers. It's gotten a little bit easier. I mean, when I first started, 25, 26 years ago, there's certain databases I can find pretty much any PE firm or any family office, mostly PE firms, just kind of on my desktop, where in the past, I just remember when I first started, I was at this really big investment bank and, there were probably 125 of us. We had files on a lot of these buyers. We had this one internal system we were trying to build and stuff like that. And it was very cumbersome doing research to try to, figure out who some of these buyers are going to be. And then even when we were doing this valuation work with companies, everything was done by hand manually with pulling down the K's and Q's from the SEC and spreading them ourselves that way versus a lot of stuff's been automated now. So it's gotten easier from that perspective. I think the books are a little bit different. They're a little bit shorter, more in that PowerPoint fashion. So it's got more efficient that way. We used to write these things that almost like a novel. It would take forever to write these things. And people just don't have the attention span for that anymore. So it's the PowerPoint side style deck is a little, that's something that's, the last 5 or 6 years has really changed. So I think it's gotten more efficient the way we go to market, and it's gotten more efficient the way we're going to researching buyers and stuff like that than 25 years ago. So those are both changes, but they're still going out and, outreach to buyers and talking in our process. That's still the same that I was doing 25 or 26 years ago when I started in this business.
Have you been able to travel less because you can do things like we're doing, like a Zoom meeting?
Somewhat. Yeah, somewhat. I'll say that though, even when 2020, after a few months, I was able to go out and get some assignments. I think, just by going out meet people in person, when a lot of people weren't doing that. Some stuff I did in 21, I think it was a direct result of me going down to meet some different people and getting on an airplane, and braving it, I guess. I think it actually helped me, So it's still doing these meetings is good and stuff like that, but still it's still helpful sometimes to meet people in person. But I think it has cut down the amount of travel that I was doing pre-pandemic.
Do the technology has continued to advance with things like real estate, where you can just go to Zillow and type in, your house address. Do you know or have heard anything of anything that you would be able to evaluate a business, any improvements in software wise that someone would be able to start to figure that out?
I really haven't. I mean, a business is kind of like a living sort of breathing organism. I haven't really seen anything that can kind of, especially on these private companies, doing that very efficiently. I haven't, not saying there's not some smart kid somewhere working on something like that right now to try to do that, but I don't know. It's just really, even with housing, it's probably somewhat difficult. I think Zillow got a little bit of trouble the way they run their models and overpaid for a bunch of stuff, I think, at one point there. But businesses are, I don't know. I think it'd be really hard. I mean, to try to do that efficiently, especially these private companies and all the nuances that are in these businesses. So I haven't seen anything that efficient.
Gotcha. What percentage of your deals include something where the existing management team or ownership sticks around for X number of years or months or whatever, versus ones that the new owners just are like, "You're out of here. We're taking over."
So I would say I think somewhere like half of our transactions are strategic buyers, and the strategic, the manager team a lot of times doesn't. The owner, the manager team usually stays no matter what, but maybe the owner won't stay in a strategic sale. He might be involved in a consulting employment for a period of time, or they might stay on in some sort of role, but they don't have to usually in those types of transactions. The private equity transactions and the family office transactions are more financial. That's probably 30-35% have been private equity, and the remainder are family deals, family office deals. The manager team almost always stays in those cases. There's usually not a manager team coming with the private equity guys. And so in those cases, they're usually going to sign employment agreements and kind of stay involved.
This is I mean, I could continue to ask questions. I've got about 15 more that I could continue to go on. Because like Josh and I said, I mean, one, we love the topics of anything to do with business. And then I know he and I are always looking at potentially maybe purchasing some other businesses. So these topics is very enjoyable, but in the interest of your time and carrying on here on this fine Friday, I don't have any other questions, and I really appreciate though you coming on today, Justin, and sharing your wealth of knowledge and the 25 years of experience that you have in the industry. And thank you for sharing everything you did with us today.
It was really nice meeting you, and thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Justin, just finally before we go, I mean, if somebody's interested in tracking you down and maybe talking to you about selling their business, if they're transitioning or whatever, where can they find you and where can we
find them? Yeah, you can send them right to my website. It's Marriott, MARRIOTT and -CO.com.
Okay.
And all my contact information is on there, my partner and the rest of my teammates. And you can read about what we do. And there's videos on there of stuff, how our process works. And former clients have done some testimonials. And then you see all the tombstones for all the deals we close. And it describes the different transactions we worked on and stuff. So it's a pretty good amount of information on our website.
Okay.
That's the best way to reach through me.
Yeah, we'll make sure when we post everything, we link out to that and include that for all of our correspondents. So,
okay. That'd be great.
All right. Well, thanks again, Justin. Yep, enjoy the weekend. Be in touch.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Healthy Team, Healthy Business Podcast. We had a great time with our guests today and hope you enjoyed the content. If you did really enjoy the content, please share this with some of your friends in your network and let them know the great stuff we're talking about on this podcast. We think all business managers ought to make sure that health, whether it be financial, mental, physical, nutrition, or be part of the discussion in the day-to-day operations of their business to have the most effective team for their operation. If you agree with this, send us an email at teamdudes@healthyteamhealthybusiness.net. Let us know some ideas for episode topics, guests you might like to see us have on, or success stories that you or some others might be able to share with us as guests on our podcast. Thanks again for joining Healthy Team, Healthy Business.